June 29, 2024. We're saying the last picture of D.C. ought not be people tearing the Capitol up and trying to tear democracy down. We need a picture of folk trying to build a democracy up and lift up all people, regardless of who they are. June the 29th on Pennsylvania and 3rd.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features exploring the notion of freedom. Africa Now is next.
Freedom!
Welcome to Charles Moise Montali. The music in the background is Freedom Sounds by the Scatterlights, commemorating Caribbean American Heritage Month. Today, WPFW presents Emancipated Spirits, Slavery, Freedom, and Resistance from 5 a.m. until midnight to commemorate Juneteenth. Thus, Africa Now goes into its archives to air a discussion which dissects the meanings of freedom in relation to Africa and the peoples of African descent. Joining the show is Dr. Greg Carr, Associate Professor of Afro-American Studies at Howard University and Adjunct Professor at the Howard School of Law. Professor Carr is First Vice President of the Association of the Study of Classical African Civilizations and Editor of Compass, the Journal of the Association of the Study of Classical African Civilizations. First, you'll hear Missy Lane, who was then with TransAfrica, reciting Frederick Douglass's speech of July 5, 1852.
Delivered on July 5, 1852, Frederick Douglass was asked to give a speech at an event commemorating the signing of the Declaration of Independence held at Rochester's Corinthian Hall. Generally, during this era, African Americans were not allowed at celebrations about freedom or independence, especially in the slaveholding South. Most of this was based on a fear by many slaveholders that slaves might develop, quote, an idea of freedom from attending events. In the North, more often than not, residents of African descent were discouraged from attending such festivities. It is within these dangerous and hostile climate that Frederick Douglass was asked by leading citizens of Rochester to give an address. What he gave them was this stinging indictment of racial oppression. We will now read from it in its abbreviated form. Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? Why have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I, therefore, called upon to bring our humble offering to your national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? Would to God, both for your sakes and ours, that an affirmative answer could be truthfully returned to these questions. Then my task would be light and my burden easy and delightful. For who is there so cold that a nation's sympathy could not warm him, so obdurate and dead to the claims of gratitude that would not thankfully acknowledge such priceless benefits? Who so stolid and selfish that would not give his voice to swell the hallelujahs of a nation's jubilee when the chains of servitude had been torn from his limbs? But such is not the state of the case. I will say it with a sad sense of the disparity between us. I am not included within the pale of glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought light and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty, your unholy license, your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are, to him, mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour. Go where you may, search where you will, roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world, travel through South America, search out every abuse, and when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation, and you will say with me that, for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival.
Thank you, Missy. Today we want to explore the idea of freedom. Freedom, a concept that seems to be multiple and complex in meaning, is a notion that is present in every corner of the world. In every society and culture, some idea of freedom is the cornerstone of the social constraints of human interaction. The idea of freedom and the various attempts to obtain a measure of it on each level of human existence, this is physical, mental, spiritual, isn't identifiable in the historical continuum of Africa and people of African descent worldwide. Here today to explore freedom and its meanings in relation to Africa and the people of African descent is Dr. Greg Carr. Welcome to Africa Now, Dr. Carr.
Thank you, Brother Moise. It's good to be here, brother. I always listen to your show, enjoy your work, and thanks for reading that, Missy, getting us in the right mood with Brother Douglas. It's good to be here.
Thanks a lot. And we started with that excerpt from Frederick Douglass' speeches. When we look at that speech, it suggests that freedom cannot mean the same thing to everybody. What does freedom mean?
Well, that's a good question. I guess there are working definitions and there are, I guess, dictionary or textbook definitions. If we look at the way the Romans looked at it, for example, the Greeks and the Romans, but I think about the Romans in particular, the word freedom coming out of the Latin and one conjugation, frere, which, I mean, literally means friend. Freedom speaks in some ways to the relationship of an individual to a group. In other words, who do you belong to? Who enables your ability to express your humanity and to grow and develop as an individual? The Romans used it to distinguish between members of the household and people who weren't members of the household, namely those who did not have freedom or enslaved. So if a person isn't a part of your family, then you treat them differently. The Greeks did something very similar. In fact, ironically, the word ethne or other, for the Greeks other than Greek, for the Romans other than Roman, and for Christians other than Christian in the Roman world, the word ethne or other is the root of the word ethnic.
Ethnic, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when we start thinking about ethnic groups, that's other than what? Well, other than Greek for the Greeks, other than Roman for the Romans, other than Christians for the Christians, other than white.
In the United States.
Yes, in a race-based society. I mean, in fact, it is also the root of the word heathen. So, I mean, it's very interesting. So freedom really means you belong. Mm-hmm. That's ironic.
And so, when we look at what Frederick Douglass was saying in his speech, what was he implicitly suggesting in the meanings, the many meanings? And I think we can, some of it comes out quite
yes.
eloquently in his speech, but some of it is sort of hidden subtly.
It's interesting. I mean, the passage that Missy read, I think, is so powerful. Douglass's words resonate to us. And when we think about at the very end, when he says, travel the world, you know, do a survey. In other words, engage in world history. Look at the modern world system for him at that point in the 1850s. He says, for barbarity and hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival. And not just in its moments when it asserts itself internationally, violence. No, he says, in its everyday practices. What did Shakespeare say, the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. It's the everyday indignities that reinscribe and reinforce for Douglass then and for us now, the reminder that, no, you are indeed not a part of what we mean when we're talking about us. So, I mean, I think that's the powerful thing that resonates throughout that piece.
So I guess when somebody, we're talking about today's world experience, when we're looking at the U.S. role in various parts of the world, for instance, Afghanistan or Iraq, and they see the military, do you have a sense that they don't see freedom? The people on the other side of the occupying, basically there's a U.S. force occupying them. So for them, freedom could be seen as freedom from the U.S.
Oh, absolutely. And the irony is that those of us in the United States who with whom that resonates, and when we look at the police often in the same way, we're able to articulate that. When you hear Slick Rick and Mos Def, for example, and when their latest joint efforts paint an incredible wordscape of Afghanistan and of Iraq with that very point. And they say this little boy is looking at the police of that place, the U.S. Army, like, hey, you guys are you're constricting my freedom. But that is a piece of art produced not by two Afghanis or mm-hmm. two Iraqis, but two Africans, one from the United States, Mos Def, and one born in the Caribbean, raised in London, Slick Rick. Mm-hmm. I mean, so you see, they understand exactly what that is.
Yeah. And it resonates because we going back to Douglas and going back to the time, whenever we look at the police role in African community, whether you're talking about the community that was taken away from the continent and brought here or the Latin America or the Caribbean, or the community that stayed, the police has been a consistent source of oppressing the freedom. I don't know if you could elaborate on that.
Oh, sure.
And how?
No, how? Go ahead.
How people see that as really being an occupying force.
In sure. I think this allows us the opportunity to explore a very widely used but little interrogated term: the nation state. The nation is an idea. In fact, it's from the Latin nasi, meaning to be born of. In other words, you belong to this entity, whether by blood or memory or collective culture. But the state is the political economic apparatus. It is the legal apparatus that enables the nation, enables the idea. And the police are the guardians of the state. So when we think about policing functions, we think about the fact that African people have resisted the states in which we have found ourselves oppressed, because our oppression has in fact created national identities. So when we look, for example, at carnival season, look at Trinidad. Juve is in fact a response against state violence. These Africans in Trinidad revolted against the police, and that became part of their ritual of independence. And so when we look at that rite of independence we call carnival, it's kicked off in Jamaica by a revolt against the state and the guardians of the state are the police.
And it's interesting you mentioned carnival, because carnival now has been sort of tamed. I mean, it has been watered down to sort of a caricature of what the Caribbean peoples are, and not really given the proper context of why the people are wearing masks, why they're putting on the mud bath. I mean, there's a lot of spiritualness and things that goes in that kind of situation. You mentioned the carnival because it was a revolt.
That's right.
Of the other culture.
That's exactly right.
And it was an expression of people trying to come back to their. Sort of what Amilcar Cabral talks about, return to the source.
Absolutely.
Where you're going back to your culture and identity and trying to be free.
Yes, yes.
In the spiritual sense.
Yes.
Because I think we look at freedom maybe too narrowly in the physical freedom. I don't know if you can expand.
Oh, no.
I think that's something that we, especially in modern life, we tend to see freedom as if it's just somebody has chained you. But there's the other bigger part of freedom. I think the most important part.
It's critical, in fact, and I'm glad you raised that, Moisa, because when you think about the idea of freedom as a concept, as something that binds us together, then we look at the rituals that celebrate freedom very differently. And make no mistake, the idea of ritual practices that bond nations and states together is so essential to how the West has dominated that they take no... they miss no opportunity to absorb the rituals of African people to align us with the goals of the state. That's why carnival can be, quote unquote, watered down. That's why Juneteenth, a very spiritual ritual for African people in this country, can be kind of forgotten as there's an attempt to integrate us into the narrative of July 4th. And in fact, look, you know, at Howard, where I work, in all black colleges, you know, what is the single most important day of the academic year? Ostensibly graduation. But ironically, if you look at the academic calendar and rituals of identity, of freedom, of belonging, you know, graduation, sure, that's what you came there for. But I would argue ostensibly that homecoming is a more sacred spiritual event in terms of the celebration of who comes into those spaces than graduation is, which means if you look at it just in the conventional Western sense, well, you came to university. That must mean graduation is the most important day. Yes, I'm grateful. Yes, I'm glad. But in terms of that convening, what this place means to us, what it means to be free within this space, it's homecoming. If we treated graduation with the same respect we treat homecoming, our educational system would be a lot further along, I think.
So you say, so should freedom have several meanings?
Yes.
Several meanings, because then listen, that idea that freedom is based on individual rights, but then you also have African concepts of freedom.
Yes.
I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on that and what the differences would be in the sort of Western notion and then the African concept of freedom.
That's an excellent question and an important avenue for us to explore. We look at the Congolese scholar, Valentin Mudembe, wrote a pamphlet many years before he wrote his book, The Invention of Africa, where he talks about this notion of freedom. And he says that part of African concepts of freedom generally speak to this corporate identity. You're part of a group. So what are your responsibilities as an individual within that group context? He says that's in direct distinction from the West, where with the West, the individual is the source of identity. So how the individual engages with other individuals becomes the premise of freedom. It's the center of everything from Magna Carta to the idea of rights and contracts. In other words, I make a contract with you. If you can get out of that contract through some legal relationship between us, then you're allowed to do that. In an Africana concept, it's not about what's on the paper. Look, man, we're part of a community. So if you do something wrong to me, you've done it to all of us and to yourself. So even notions of justice are very differently engaged when it comes to African concepts. And I think, generally speaking, when we talk about Africa, whether it be the continent, the Caribbean, Latin America, North America, we talk about African people, this idea of belonging, this idea of a corporate identity, this idea of a shared space really is the center of what defines freedom. So that, for example, let me give you another example I think is important. An individual's success, an academic who publishes a string of books, a ball player who makes $50 million, you know, a great performer who goes out and sells millions of records worldwide, that's something that if they're black, African people share a sense of collective, you know, wow, we did this. But if that person behaves in a way that they separate themselves from the community, if they separate themselves from the community then separates themselves from that person, but only conditionally, because we always make space for that person to
come
return.
Back.
Right, because our concept is very flexible when it comes to that.
And you're listening to Dr. Greg Carr. We're talking about the concept of freedom. This is a pre-recorded show of Africa Now on WPFW, so we'll be not taking phone calls. And I hope you enjoy the show. And going back on that concept, the Africanness of freedom, do you think it's because when we talk about, is it because of the oppression that's gone through the history in the last 400 years, people could say, that we have redefined freedom within the African culture and the African-American culture, the Afro-Caribbean culture, the Afro-Latino culture, because of the oppression? Or was it always been there that if you sort of step out and not claim responsibility for the community, that we don't accept you? Do you think it's because of the oppression that there's been a sort of redefinition, or has it always been there, that the definition you described?
Mm-hmm. I think it's both. I think it's both. Our experiences have forced us to absorb certain things that were not something that we had in our definitions, but we've also emptied into these new spaces our pre-existing definitions. So that it's a new thing, but it's more African than it is anything else in terms of our experience. And what I mean by that, I guess if we think about this notion of corporate identity, prior to our enslavement, the enslavement colonialist closing process, we find ourselves in configurations that still had that notion of group and collective welfare, but we didn't give ourselves names that we might now consider ethnic names, Igbo or Yoruba. Mm-hmm. I mean, these things, of course, you know, link into the languages. But as the colonial moment and the enslavement moment ensued, and we found ourselves emptied into these spaces where we were forced together as a consequence of oppression, we actually used our cultural identities to forge these larger group identities. And of course, that's, of course, where Black comes from. Black is a name we were given, but the sensibility of Blackness was, in fact, an African African blending, constant blending, reblending, reblending, reblending. And then as we fought for emancipation and for liberation, those struggles were informed by that collective sense. Now, here's the irony, I think. As the system realized, the world system realized that it could not contain us, it then began to absorb parts of that resistance and tried to restructure how we resisted to more closely align itself to the states we found ourselves in. So we began to pursue freedom along the lines of sensibilities that came out of the West. So now it became not just a collective resistance and a collective revolt. It became, let us pursue our rights in the courts. Wait. What does that mean? Your rights don't come from a document. Your rights come from a notion of a worldview. But the worldview of the West is very subtle in that regard, because freedom is not something that exists in the West. The nation state is a failed idea. It's coming apart at the seams for people who are not of African descent. But what Africans have done since that time is continuing this kind of real contestation to pursue freedom along these African cultural sensibility lines, while at the same time availing themselves of the tools of the state. I think that's what the civil rights movement teaches us in the United States.
And do you think also that was also the same movement, I think, in the African liberation movement? There was two-pronged. They also had, the armed struggle liberation movement, but they also had in other countries where there was demonstrations, different demonstrations, similar to the civil rights movement.
That's right.
And do you think they had the same type? So you're saying they had the same philosophy, they followed the same notion that you're saying, that using sort of Western ideas but having a sort of an African foundation to achieve this freedom?
That's no question.
Yeah.
It's no question. In fact, this is another great irony. When African governments, continental African governments, for example, are criticized for being anti-democratic, I just laugh. I said, first of all, democracy didn't exist. It didn't exist in Greece. It wasn't any Greece. It didn't exist in Athens. All you got to do is read Solon and look at Democritus. And you realize you never meant for everybody to participate. You had an elite, and you wanted the rest of these people to give you their consent. That's the heart of republicanism, or what some people call, Cornel West among them, I think, in a very misguided, well-informed, but misguided gesture toward the West, small d democracy, whatever the heck that is. But in Africa, when you see an election, unlike the West, where you can actually have an election stolen, a couple of them even, in fact, in a row, and go home because it's just a vote. Oh, no. See, everybody participates in this thing. So if you steal an election in Kenya, we're going to have a fight. Why? Because we actually believe in group participation. Say, so, oh, this is a failed state. Yes, it is. Thank God. We have to get rid of the violence. We have to deal with the corruption. But what we cannot abandon is the underlying sensibility that fueled this anger. The anger is premised on we must all participate, and that's something the West has never believed in. In fact, we did our best to try to Africanize the United States during the Civil Rights Movement, but it too seems to be a failed experiment. You didn't go to Mississippi to teach these people about the Constitution. You went to Mississippi and found out about shared governance. So when Fannie Lou Hamer comes in 1964 to Atlantic City and say, I question America, she's not saying, I need to know about democracy. She's saying, no, I, as an African in Mississippi, I may never fill my name out on this ballot, but I know what it means that all of us got to eat. All of us going to go to work. All of us going to have something to go to and go home to. And if that's what this Constitution says, then I'm for it. But if it doesn't, then I, the subject, the African subject, question America. And I think on the continent of Africa, we've done the same thing with these failed nation state experiments. And Basil Davidson wrote a book about that 20 years ago, The Curse of the Nation State.
Yeah, and it was the Black Man's Burden as well. That's the name of the book.
Black Man's Burden. That's exactly right. Yeah. That's the main title. That's right.
And it's interesting because in that book, I mean, it really reaffirms what Cabral had been saying.
Yes.
20 years earlier, or well, not even 20, 30 years earlier, about looking at the institutions of the African culture, going back to those institutions. And having a foundation for the next for the independence movements, do you think that the competition between the Western freedom concept and the African freedom concept has resulted in some inadequate freedom?
Yes, I think so. In fact, this is really something. When we think about the fact that humanity came from Africa, and we think about the fact that African people have had the longest experience on the planet trying to work out the human problems that we all share, I think in some ways Africans have formed in part the vanguard of humanity, attempting to some way rid ourselves of the virus of some kind of unproductive ways of governing ourselves. And by that, I mean unproductive ways of collectively as human beings forming societies. Many of the West's experiments are failed ideas. And what we see in Africa are increasing attempts to kind of get beyond those ideas and come back to, and as you say, Cabral, I think, was brilliant, as you said, in that regard, get back to some things that we knew were right, take the experiences of things that we've had since those origins and try to incorporate them and without, you know, learning the lessons. And it's interesting, there's a new book that came out on neoliberal Africa. And one of the things that the author talks about is the fact that, in fact, Africa may be more advanced than other places in understanding neoliberalism and perhaps ridding ourselves of neoliberalism, because these societies were accelerated along that track by the West. And what we find in places like the United States and Canada, what we see now on the front page of the New York Times today, the global, you know, the G20 just met, but there's a G8 inside the G20. And what they want to do perhaps is, you know, how can we keep this thing going? Maybe we'll reduce debt and get private. Hey, this thing is not going to work. It's not going to work for you. And when the thing collapses, you know, Greece portends whatever is going to happen next. When this thing collapses, who is going to be best prepared for the world that it comes after that? It ain't going to be us. And by us, I mean those of us in the United States. It's probably going to be those places that have a little bit more experience with the raw blade of neoliberalism and neocolonialism in many ways. And I think Africa may be better poised to actually emerge from this maybe a little bit farther along in terms of trying to help the world understand what comes next.
You think even with the fact that some of the elites are very much incorporated with the elites of the established world, I mean the Western capital world?
Well, no, I mean that's, again, it's not a done proposition. It's not a done deal. In the latest issue of New Left Review, in fact, the last article in the journal, Emmanuel Wallerstein gives it at best, in his estimation, a 50-50 chance that the world is going to be able to emerge out of this. He says, what we can do at this point is try to do the best we can within these existing systems to try to forge a better understanding to help people move from day to day, but prepare for what comes next. And he gives it 50-50. I think the kind of comprador elite in Africa, the comprador elite in the Caribbean and Latin America, the compradors here in the United States, Africa, I think, has a better chance, if no other reason, than the masses of people perhaps are better positioned to revolt against that kind of thing. I mean, you see, and people talk about coup d'etats. Well, sometimes that's about, look, this guy's corrupt. And when we look at Nigeria, how come Nigeria hasn't completely dissolved over the last 50 years? Some people may scratch their heads and say, I don't know why. No, think about this. If the leadership is corrupt and it cannot be put out of its place immediately, what are Africans going to do? They're going to organize on the micro level, at the level of the family. So they say, well, they've got an incredible black market. The economic system in Nigeria doesn't work. No, I think it works fine. What these people have realized is the sun's coming tomorrow, I got to eat. So whether I'm hocking these bootleg DVDs or whether it's Harlem or Lagos, I'm going to tell you right now, that crook in the office, we'll deal with him tomorrow. But today, we're going to make this thing operate. And that's going to be Kingston, Jamaica, Port-au-Prince, Port-au-Spain, Salvador. We are going to survive. D.C. Now, some people are going to look up if the banks go out tomorrow and they're going to be in trouble. Why? Hey, I had $1 million in the bank. Now I don't have anything. And who will they turn to? Well, then at that point, Africa's going to lead again.
Does my right to freedom have to be in direct competition with your right to ability to be free? Is that something that...
It doesn't have to be, I think, but the relationship again speaks to that. It's funny. About a month ago, I went up to New York to the J.P. Morgan Library. They had the Magna Carta up there. It was the first time it had left England, and then they had the volcano, so they couldn't take it back for like a month, so it delayed. I said, "Oh, this is my chance." So I went up there. I'm looking at this little piece of paper that looks like two pieces of notebook paper stuck together. Yeah. That's how little it is, right? Yes. And I'm looking at this thing like, in this document in Latin is the idea that the state cannot lock you up forever without producing its evidence, habeas corpus. And they're saying from this document and the idea that fueled it comes all the Western jurisprudence. And I'm laughing to myself like, yeah, y'all just figured that out. In other words, you can't do that. You can't do it. But if we look at African concepts, it's all about relationships, rights and persons. That's why slavery couldn't be understood by the West. They said, well, Africans had slavery. No, what you have is rights and persons. Now, we were all children. which meant at some point we did something we didn't want to do. We were unfree labor in that regard. So, you know, the freedom to eat, the freedom to sleep, the freedom to be protected also had as part of it a responsibility to do the dishes or mow the lawn or do something else. And we didn't want to do it, but our parents could say, look, you belong to me. Now, that may be misinterpreted in the West. So you may have a child in the West say, I'm going to sue my parents. Wait, hold on. There's a relationship here. A constriction of one's movement isn't necessarily an abdication of one's rights. What are the rights? Mm-hmm. Are you talking about rights as an individual or rights as a part of a community? The premise has to be examined before we can even start talking about contestation, I think.
And that's Dr. Greg Carr. We're talking about the concept of freedom. And we're going to take a short break. You're listening to a special show from African Owls Archives, which is a discussion that dissects the meanings of freedom in relation to Africa and the peoples of African descent. And we present this as WPFW presents a day-long special entitled Emancipated Spirits, Slavery, Freedom, and Resistance. And that's from 5 a.m. until midnight today to commemorate Juneteenth. Featured on the show is Dr. Greg Carr, Associate Professor of Afro-American Studies at Howard University and Adjunct Professor at Howard School of Law. The music in the background is Sun Goddess by Ramsey Lewis, commemorating Black Music Month. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW, 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the show. Welcome back to Africa Now. And of course, that was Stevie Wonder, Black Man. And I just want to talk about that song a little bit because it's from his famous album, actually probably one of the greatest albums made in R&B, Songs in the Key of Life, which came out in 1976. And he was talking about when he wrote that song, he wrote it during the bicentennial month. And he was really talking about his similar discussion we're talking about how freedom and just the quest for freedom and independence and whose history is honored. And a bit, I don't know if you can elaborate, because in his song, he's making praise of all people being part of this country and benefiting and also making it what it is. And then he talks about pledging allegiance to the red, white, green, red, blue, and white. Yes. And so you can see that there's a in his song is yearning that so that the freedom is not complete and the people have taken for granted as well as more than taken for granted ignored the accomplishments of other people and other people have been given more due respect than others. So I don't know if you could elaborate on that.
No, I think Moise, it was fortuitous that you would play that song. I think Wonder is an amazing example. I mean, first of all, we can just go with the fact that he was born Steve Land Morris. The idea of freedom as it speaks to the self-naming and the declaring of space. you know, you link yourself to your aspiration. You know, little Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
But the wonder comes in many ways his prophetic voice. So when we think about that period, particularly the 1970s and the mid-70s and the work that he did, and Songs in the Key of Life, of course, being the kind of watershed moment, I think about his continuing attempt to articulate this sense of the possible while being clear-eyed about where we were. So it's almost like he's saying, this is where we must go in this country, but ultimately we will survive America, to quote from Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture. He has a song, Higher Ground. Mm-hmm. So if you fail this time, I mean, Wonder says, you know, I'm so glad that he let me try it again, because my first time on earth, I lived a hovel of sin. I'm so glad that I know now more than I knew then, and I'm going to keep on trying until I reach the task. I mean, in that period, he's saying, okay, this is where we must go. But if we don't go there, we may have to leave you. And I think the black response to the bicentennial in 1976, I think that's very interesting, because Philadelphia was a good example of that. Frank Rizzo was the mayor of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. He gave money to start an African-American museum in Philadelphia in some ways to appease the black community, who seized the moment of the bicentennial to say, no, what about us? And it's not that we just want some black exhibits down there on the Independence Hall. We want our own space out of which to declare how we fit to this narrative. Because America, even though it calls itself a nation state, is in fact not a nation state. It is a state with multiple nations. That's exactly right. And black people have always been very clear. Oh, yeah, there are parts of this we will, you know, kind of get in line with or move toward critically. And there are other parts we don't want any part of. So if you look at black people on the 4th of July, the flags will wave and everything will be nice, firecrackers will go off, and then where are black folks? On a day off, barbecuing. You know, I'm not really crying when the red, white, and blue goes up. And if you do see a tear shed, it's because somebody's in their family was a veteran. And blood sacrifice has a funny way of binding you to the nation, even if it's not uncritically. So anyway, it's very complex, and Wonder captures so much of that.
Yeah, because it's very interesting. I mean, because people, I'm not sure if they listen to that song very carefully,
I never listened to Stevie Wonder.
That's right,
brother.
But it's interesting because you mentioned something about the freedom of him naming himself. And I always tell people about how African Americans, when people say, well, how come your name is LaQuisha or LaShawn and stuff like that? What the heck is that? And it's but I said, no, actually, in a way, that is a rebellion. Mm-hmm. Because for a long time, from the beginning of when African people were brought here, the first thing, I mean, when you think of roots, the first thing that always, the image I always have is the when he's told to get rid of his name.
Yes.
Because once you tell somebody the name is this, or you can name them.
Yes.
They're not free.
That's right.
They're not. I mean, because if you cannot do the most important thing, I mean, that's probably one thing that you can do.
That's right.
Is name your child.
That's right.
And if can't do that, you can't have the identity.
That's right.
What can you do?
They can't. I mean, John Henry Clark said, a name links you to land, history, and culture. And when I think about what Ngugi Wa Thiong'o wrote in his latest book, Something Torn and New, the act of dismemberment. I must take your name. Without your name, you don't have your memory. You don't belong to anything. That's exactly right. So that act of self-naming is very interesting, Moise, as you say. We don't know the Yoruba. We don't have the Akan languages. We don't have the Kiswahili in the same way, but we will take those sounds if that is all we have left, and we will forge an identity. And one of the interesting things since the 60s that you see in a profusion of Islamic names, as African people say, okay, I'm going to take the Malik. I'm going to take, you know, and I don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, I may not know, you know, I can't say Olorun. I don't know, you know, mm-hmm. Olufemi, but I will say Jamisha. You know, I'm going to say that name because it's something about that name. You cannot corrupt that name.
It's mine.
It's my name, I belong to this group that has similar vowels. I mean, it's a very interesting
thing. And that's a source of freedom.
Oh, of course. That's
a tremendous source of freedom, because once you have that, then I think people make fun of it, but it's an important, I mean, if you can do that, then everything else is like gravy.
That's right.
Because it's and we tend to dismiss it, because a lot of times in the African culture, the name means something.
Absolutely.
The name, when you're given a name, it's not just the name. Like my name was given because my grandmother on my father's side had passed away a few months before I was born. So your name, that name Mwiza, comes after.
Ah.
So I can never change that name. Because if I change that name, I'll be in trouble.
That's right. Oh, my God. You know, it's funny you said it, because in African naming traditions in the United States, there is a deep tradition of creating that come after moment. But since we didn't have the complex and the rich, and for me, the most intellectually challenging oral systems in the world, and in African naming, you see it. Since we didn't have that at our ready fingertips, we would put the nickname on. So your name might be John, but if your father is Richard, they may call you Little Richard. I mean, they put the little in front all the time. Big Mike, Little Mike. What does that mean?
But to create that linkage.
To create the linkage.
You gotta have the foundation somewhere, because you can't. Because the biggest problem with that, when they rename, I was going back to Kunta Kinte, he's like, when they take away that name, he's like, that person's history didn't exist. Before I came along, I'm the one who has the history. I'm the one who has, and it's really powerful. But do you think that some people are scared of freedom? Do you think people are scared of freedom?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And what it means?
Absolutely. I mean, particularly African people. I won't say exclusively, of course. This is a human question. But for African people, absolutely, because with freedom comes responsibility. Again, freedom means you are linked to a community, even in the Roman and the Greek, as I said, but certainly in the African. So let's take, for example, the idea, the work that you do, for example, you know, TransAfrica here, WPFW, you don't just get on the microphone and say anything because you feel a responsibility. But that, some people might see that as a burden, and it is indeed does indeed require effort, but ultimately it's the individual contributing to the greater good. So if you are truly free, That means that whatever you're commenting on, whatever you're doing, you must do for the greater good of humanity, of your group, of the greater humanity. And that's a challenge. Why would people who are not ready for that responsibility want it? And I think what Western cultures do generally is encourage, in some ways, human irresponsibility. So, you know, I think about this, we're in the age of public intellectuals these days, and you got people, man, who will say anything, first thing come out of their head, and you say, why did you say that? Well, I've had to be free to express myself. That's not freedom. That's irresponsibility. You don't want the responsibility of freedom, because the responsibility of freedom means you must be part of and declare a space where people can be people, not just you, free to be human in the world. And that's not about just freedom of expression. That's about a responsibility to your fellow person, yeah.
And so do you think that generally we're scared of freedom in the wider population? We're scared of what that responsibility, what it means to be, because being free means you have to choose leaders.
Right.
Being free means you have to go to the PTA meeting. Being
That's
free
right.
means you got to go to do the civic duties. So That's do you right. think people are afraid of freedom?
Absolutely. I think, and then we can look even at the recent presidential election last couple of years. People are criticizing Barack Obama, and certainly I'm one of the people who says, you know, perhaps you could do this a little differently. I mean, I, for example, would have liked to have seen a black woman picked for the Supreme Court. I mean, that's one of the few things president gets to do. Nobody gets, you know. But we have to have the freedom to make the president do these things. In other words, it's not enough to vote and say, okay, I voted, now do it. No. You've abdicated your responsibility of your freedom. Freedom means participation. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you have to go to PTA meeting. You have to now lobby. I mean, the Tea Party movement, people can hem and haw and say, oh, these people are crazy. Okay, but what are you doing? See, they, ironically, they're expressing some modicum of freedom. They are bonding together to get their voice heard. And we have to do the same thing in this country, I think, or globally as well.
So one definition of freedom is participation in the greater community.
Yes, absolutely.
Civic duty to be free.
Absolutely.
That you cannot be a human being without participating in the greater good of society.
That's right. That's not a full human being. And ultimately, people, for the fear that people have sometimes, I think when you push past that fear, you see the great reward. Because there's, and this goes right back to we're talking about this question of African culture and how African people have generally, I think there's no greater feeling than that feeling of belonging. And the feeling of belonging, particularly when there's been individual sacrifice and participation, is just deepened and enriched. You feel like, you know, I helped build this. And I think that's why rituals are so important. The African independence celebrations, remembering our great heroes, you know, the notions of community. Those rituals are very important because they also speak to shared sacrifice and the individual's commitment. So that's very important.
I want to touch on that as well. Do you think there's a difference between African-American and African-American definition of freedom? I mean, we've talked about it
sure.
in a broad sense, but if you can narrow it down, do you think there is a definite difference or nuanced difference?
Maybe a little bit of, maybe a lot of both, but I would say more nuanced difference. Outright differences, I don't think so. However, And this, I think about Ron Walters, the great political scientist, who talks about the idea that you have states in which Africans are the majority and they in control of the nominal political apparatus. And then you have states where Africans are the minority and have to operate in that context. So when you look at Africans in the United States, for example, and Africans maybe on the continent of Africa, and even in the Caribbean, there will be a qualitative difference in how they participate in government as a consequence of their status, majority or minority. But if you look at how African people govern themselves in the United States in the spaces they control, I think you see then that's where you see the differences are more a difference of degree. So, I mean, yeah, sure, if you look at the state house and look at black legislators in Maryland or Virginia or in the national legislature, Congress, you may say, well, wow, you don't seem to be as animated and as passionate about this or as able to really advance your ideas as you might be, say, for example, in the Kenyan National Parliament or in the National Parliament of Jamaica. Okay, yeah, but follow that same person to their church and see them at the deacon board and see the different kind of behavior, and what you'll see is, okay, this is a difference that is really one of kind of a qualitative distinction that is much closer together. So, I mean, but I think it's a complex issue, but as we think about black governance, and African notions of freedom, we have to look at the context in which black people are in some form of control to be able to compare, mm-hmm. rather than look at these things from state to state.
And I think you touched on something which is which brings us to the Pan-Africanist movement.
Yes.
And the role of African and African Americans in that movement, because it's something which is not often discussed as deeply. And also, I think we also sort of start, we always start at Du Bois at the beginning of the century, but we forget that there was an AME church.
Yes, that's there was right.
And why is the A?
That's right. And the Prince Hall Masons, before they were the Prince Hall Masons, they were the African Lodge.
Yeah. So there was always a look towards the Africa. I mean, there's always been a look toward Africa for African people in America from the beginning.
Yes.
And it's just that somehow it was suppressed.
Yes.
And I don't know if you could touch on that. Could you talk about the solidarity?
Oh, sure.
Of African and African peoples worldwide. And in the quest for freedom.
Our central challenge really is the challenge to displace the West as the center around which we organize our worlds. And we see that in the Pan-African movement. For those Africans who were displaced physically, who were taken away, the notion of independence congealed largely around being able to assert one's freedom of movement, one's rights. And so when the Pan-African movements of the 20th century started, what we see very clearly is that African people are bringing those sensibilities back into the conversation. So whether it be Henry Sylvester Williams coming out of Trinidad, spending some time in South Africa, and then coming to London to call the first Pan-African Conference in 1900, there weren't continental Africans there. Obviously, Africa is going through its own struggle with colonialism. But you have Africans saying, independence, we need independence.
Yes, I think there was somebody from Ethiopia there.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's, you're right, right. Yeah. But generally speaking, I'm thinking about now, by the time we get to 1945 in Manchester, though, of course, they're
then
there.
Everybody there.
And then you see, but ironically, 10 years later in Bandung, now the colored worlds are saying, we're not going to align, because he had this Cold War struggle going on. But the Africans who are outside of places where they're the majority are very almost obsessed with this independence and this kind of construct. By the time we get to 7-PAC, it just blows out into the open. Now you have these guys, whether it be Baraka and these folks coming to East Africa, and there's a struggle between Africans from the continent and Africans from the United States about notions of who's an African, how is Africa, what is Africa, and that echoes to this day. And one of the things we have to get beyond, though, is these artificial lines that divide us, so that the issues that we don't agree on, we can either reach some consensus or have some coexistence, but it can't be organized around this idea that somehow our freedom is tethered to these failed ideas that have come out of a West that is quickly eroding.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to bring it back to the going back beyond the 1900s. Because I think there's not enough. People always talk, because there have been some. There's John Chilembwe who was a
Chilembwe,
who was from the Nyasla, now Malawi. Came in the 1900s and worked with people who later on became the Garveyites.
Yes.
And so there's the notion of also Pan-Africanism is maybe needs to be redefined, the solidarity, that it's not just that that during the 1900s.
I see what you mean.
I think it's a longer history.
Oh, yeah.
Which probably hasn't been properly.
Well, in fact, I would say that Pan-Africanism may begin with the unification of Upper and Lower Kemet of Egypt by Menes around 3500 BC. Anytime you go to some place that you're not from and you all begin to build solidarity, that's Pan-Africanism. So then you come through the formation of the Western states and the Sudan. There's a Pan-African moment in Askiel Muhammad. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are you doing, man? I'm pulling these people together. Shaka, the Zulu are not everybody. The political formation that becomes the Zulu, I think.
Not all of them are Zulus.
It's no question. Yeah. The Ashantis even. I mean, when Yasantiwa gives this speech, oh, you men of Ashanti, are you going to fight the British or not? It's a Pan-African moment. When you see Nzinga in Angola in the 17th century doing this, Pan-Africanism. Then you jump across the Atlantic. Absolutely. Vodun is a Pan-African moment. Fon, Dahomey, Yoruba, all blending, and then you come together. Toussaint Louverture, particularly Dessalines, a Pan-African expression. Dessalines comes to the United States fighting on behalf of the French against the British for the Americans, comes back to the island and says, you know, C.L.R. James writes about this. Not only the French get liberty, equality, and fraternity, this is us as well. And you see Africans in the United States hearing about the Haitian Revolution. So when you see the Denmark Vesey Rebellion, when they put those guys on trial, some of them say, we were told if we could get to the dock at Charleston, a boat was coming from Saint Dominique, mm-hmm. and we were going where the blacks are in charge. And it's like, this is Pan-Africanism. Simon Bolivar, the Haitians under Petion give him money and guns to go fight that fight in Latin America. This is a Pan-African moment. So Hugo Chavez, this ain't nothing new. And he knows that.
Yeah.
I mean, and then, of course, by the time you get there and you have Martin Delaney and you have, I mean, you know, a Mariah Stewart and you have Prince Hall coming from Barbados, living in Boston, starting the Masons that then name themselves after him. These are Pan-African movements. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because sometimes what's frustrating, because it seems like people always just end it at the 1996, but people have been yearning for this forever. whether you're talking about the especially the church. When I always say, well, what does AME mean? You know, people always say AME, but they don't reflect on what the A means, and they just say AME. Just like, okay. AME.
In fact, I'm glad you said it, Moise. In the AME church, the second bishop of the AME church was Morris Brown. Morris Brown was from South Carolina. Morris Brown was in South Carolina when they planned the Vesey Rebellion. They had different regiments in the Vesey Rebellion organized around the different language groups of Africa, and they had one group for the Africans born in the United States. They said, we want you to participate, but we don't know if we can trust you guys because y'all were born here, and we think y'all may have some divided loyalties. How about the fact that Morris Brown, who after Richard Allen was the second bishop of the AME Church, is buried in Philadelphia. Why? Because after helping perhaps plan the Vesey Rebellion, some people say he may have been part of that, he left the state to go to Pennsylvania. When they caught those guys, they passed a law and said that anybody who was free before, a black in South Carolina, cannot come back. Morris Brown is buried in Mother Bethel Church in Philadelphia because he was part ostensibly of a Pan-African rebellion in the AME church. I mean, and they had the AME church in South Carolina. Vesey was a preacher in the church.
And then finally, I wanted to ask you about, are we free? Is there anything to be resisted today? If you could elaborate, have we reached the pinnacle of freedom?
I think the first freedom we have is the freedom within our individual selves of breaking that chain. Of breaking that chain of memory, so that first freedom is the freedom to connect with ourselves and our greater understanding of each other as individuals. And so we are able to determine whether we're free or not every day as an individual trying to connect. Generally speaking, society certainly shows us that we're not yet free. Who knows if we can ever be free? I mean, but we certainly have to aspire to it because I think that's the measure of our humanity.
And do we know that we're not free?
Oh no, we know. You know, we know we are not. You know, we don't know. Because they had the BET Awards on the other night, so you already know. Chris Brown playing Michael Jackson, and they forgot Rihanna. No, we're clear. We're clear that we do not know that we are not free. That's right. We got a long way to go on that one, brother. But thankfully, shows like this help.
and also your eloquent description and analysis help us to attain that. And I think a lot of it has to be the fact that the suppression from the institution has really, really been done a great I mean, has really has perfected the lack of understanding of freedom and other things within the the African world.
Yes.
So it's and so I guess we can't dismiss that totally.
No. The mediator function is really important. The electronic media, the print media, these things reinscribe notions that can, in some ways, distract us. I would agree with Noam Chomsky in that regard. The media creates necessary illusions because they manage democracy that way in other systems. Yeah.
And that's Dr. Greg Carr from Howard University. We've been talking about freedom, and I hope you enjoyed the show. You've just been listening to a special presentation of Africa Now from its archives. And this was a discussion that dissected the meanings of freedom in relation to Africa and the peoples of African descent. Joining the show was Dr. Greg Carr, Associate Professor of Afro-American Studies at Howard University and Adjunct Professor at the Howard School of Law. Professor Carr is also First Vice President of the Association of the Study of Classical African Civilizations and Editor of the Compass, the Journal of the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilizations. This is part of WPFW's special presentation today entitled Emancipated Spirits, Slavery, Freedom, and Resistance, which is a day-long special from 5 a.m. until midnight, commemorating Juneteenth today. The music in the background is Fight the Power by Public Enemy, commemorating Black Music Month. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muiza Muntali. WPFW's special presentation, Emancipated Spirits, Slavery, Freedom, and Resistance, continues with Sha'anana with Zain al-Amin, and he's looking at Juneteenth and the Palestinian liberation struggle. And that's followed by Sophie's Parlor with Marietta Lucia and Dera Thompson. And that's followed by Human Rights and Justice with Nkechi Taifa. And today it's looking at Scholars Juneteenth Roundtable, Ubuntu Climate, Freedmen's Settlement, and Black Psychology, which is followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly. That's followed by Gombit Lakai with Junior Charles, which is looking at Haitian independence and Juneteenth. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host, James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nasella and Kalia Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Shonda Kozer and Funangonda, and our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erdison. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free by Nina Simone. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
Hi, this is Robin Holden. On Sunday, July 7th, from 4 until 8 p.m., WPFW is presenting a fundraising evening of roots, rock, and reggae at Mango Cafe, 4719 Annapolis Road in Blaytonsburg, Maryland, featuring the Proverbs Reggae Band with Z Lion and special guests Freedom and Saroma Lee L. Proceeds to benefit WPFW. Details, WPFWFM.org.
Hi, this is Tom Cole, host of G-Strings here on WPFW every Sunday morning. I and the rest of the station's volunteers and staff would like to invite you to join the WPFW Legacy Listener Circle by making a contribution to the station's future through your estate plan. There are a lot of ways to do that, through your IRA or retirement plan, by gifting us life insurance, or through your donor-advised fund. We'd be happy to have a confidential discussion with you as you consider a planned gift to the station. Please reach out to us at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or call us at 202-588-0999. Thank you for considering becoming a part of WPFW's future.
Do you love WPFW? Now is your chance to get involved by participating in the local station board. Run for a seat on the board by becoming a candidate between June 1st and June 30th. Complete your candidate package located on elections.pacifica.org. Call 707-500-1910 to leave a voicemail for the election supervisor.
You believe in